Welcome, everyone. thank you. Today, I wanted to talk to you about a way of performing Monte Carlo, standard unbiased Monte Carlo simulations, taking advantage of all the power of precision that we can get out of tensor network techniques. Okay, so it's sort of I'm talking to you today about a hybrid numerical method and some benchmark results and so on. Okay, so I mean, all this research was funded by the Marie Curie, I suppose you should say. Should mention where the money comes from. So what is the point of all this? Well, you know, numerics has sort of become a third way of doing science beyond just experiments and pure theory, where you can kind of perform sort of numerical experiments on your computer and solve theories and try and match everything up. And so we're always, you know, trying to solve new problems, more difficult problems, and needing new techniques and algorithms. And what is particularly valuable in this context is generic tools, tools that can be applied to a wide range of situations. Things like Monte Carlo, you don't just see in physics, but you see in finance, you see in biology, you see everywhere, right? So you know, what we're trying to do here is create a tool which is both powerful and quite generic. Okay, so that's the scientific motivation. The motivation to me 5 years ago was this man over here, Geoffrey Vidal, who was the boss. I had just finished a PhD in a different field and just was starting to learn about tensor networks. And so my assigned task was to create a new type of simulation combining the best aspects of Monte Carlo and tensor network techniques. So this was 5 years ago. And so today I'm talking about some positive results, but I'll just first explain the story of what happened in 2010 in Australia. So the basic idea is this. We have Monte Carlo methods, which have been around for quite some time now. It was one of the first things people thought of to do with computers when they came along. So Monte Carlo techniques are said to be unbiased, which means that when I take many Monte Carlo samples, so Monte Carlo is based on random sampling, when I take an infinite number of samples, the result should converge to the exact answer, okay? You know, and not only that, you'll get an error estimate from the statistics, you can parallelize it, but it has some disadvantages. Because of statistics, the convergence is just the square root of the number of samples, this just comes from statistics. If you're doing quantum problems, you can end up with sign problems, which means it's almost useless for some problems. You know, progress is made every now and again, but it's still very challenging. And another interesting thing about Monte Carlo, which I'll talk about today, is the choice of basis. So the basis that you do your Monte Carlo sampling in can have a profound impact on the way it behaves. Okay. Tensor networks are a newer numerical approach, which converge rapidly. So they don't have, in terms of computer power that you apply, They once they start to converge, they approach the real exact solution quite rapidly, maybe super polynomially in some cases. Okay, and in these cases, you can be very precise, like DMRG might give you 10 orders of magnitude of precision or more, right? You can solve problems that are thought to have the sign problem with Monte Carlo. You know, there's some disadvantages, there's some inherent bias towards states which have less correlations, things we call variational error, and so on. To get good results, you might need very large bond dimensions, and it might take up too much computer time and computer memory. And so for some problems which are challenging, maybe it doesn't work so well. And another big thing is you don't have this nice error estimate from the statistics of Monte Carlo. So, I mean, you have to do some careful extrapolation and think about, you know, is my simulation even getting the entirely wrong phase or something in the tensor network approach? And so this is a real concern. Okay. And so the hope was that we would combine these two techniques and end up with mostly all the pros and none of the cons. And after a year of effort on the mirror, we ended up with this. Okay. So what we've done is we've crossed out most of the good points by what we had done is attempted to do variational Monte Carlo with tensor network states. And this had been tried before by other groups, but also us. And so we actually, you know, you had variational error, you had statistical error, you had this additional problem with optimization, and so not only did you cross out most of the green points, you're adding more red points. And so basically, at this point, we both got so depressed that we left the lovely weather of Australia and moved to Canada. The different cities, but nonetheless. So the new approach here, what I want to tell you today, is instead of trying to improve variational tensor network using variational Monte Carlo, which is sort of combining, you know, bad things with bad things, we're going to do the standard, straightforward, unbiased Monte Carlo. So this is a Monte Carlo method, and we're going to use some ideas from tensor networks to define the sort of basis that we do the Monte Carlo sampling in. Okay, so it's a Monte Carlo method, and we're going to use bases and ideas from renormalization of tensor networks. So because it's a Monte Carlo method, I just want to define quickly what Monte Carlo is. So at its heart, it's just you have some large sum you want to, or an integral, and you want to calculate it. But maybe there are millions or billions of, or you know, a very large number of elements in this sum, and we can't go through them one at a time and calculate it. So what we do is we just pick a few at random, and you can get an estimate of this sum, right? And the error that you'll get depends on the variance of this quantity and the number of samples. So this is the expected error, right? And so it gets a bit more complicated if you think of distributions with long tails or that are skewed, but more or less it's something like this, okay? We can improve upon this by not just choosing elements at random, but choose them at random according to some probability distribution. And you can think of this as some kind of preconditioning or something, where the variance of this thing might be, in fact, significantly less than the original variance. Okay, so important sampling is very important to make the whole Monte Carlo idea work well. Okay, so one such example, which is common, and I'm going to talk about mostly in this talk, is just classical systems and the partition function. So we're talking about a classical system at thermal equilibrium. At the end of the talk, I'll talk about quantum systems at thermal equilibrium, but for now, let's just focus on the classical thing, because there's no sign problems and no confusion or anything. Okay, it's very simple. So the partition function is defined as the sum over all the Boltzmann weights of every possible physical configuration S. Okay, so this is the energy, and beta is the inverse temperature. The energy of a system is typically local. It can normally be written as a sum of a few body terms, so like nearest neighbor terms or something on some lattice, let's say. Okay, but generally it's local or few body. And from the partition function, you know, we can calculate the derivatives of the partition function and so on, and we can get all the observables that we want. So sometimes just calculating the partition function itself is our goal. Other times, it's just one feature, a normalization feature to do with statistical mechanical problems, and we actually want to calculate observables directly, but it's sort of more or less the same thing. But this partition function, when you have a local Hamiltonian, energy is a sum of local terms, well, the exponential of a sum of terms is the product of the exponential of terms. So we can write it Z as a sum over all configurations, times the product of coefficients, more or less, just numbers. This is just a number that depends on two spin variables, let's say. Let's say we're doing an Ising model or something simple where every site has a spin. Okay? And we can write down this partition function, this formula, in terms of a tensor network. So if our lattice is a two-dimensional square lattice, we can just call this thing here a tensor itself. It's an object which depends on two things, Si and Sj, right? So we call that T. T is a two-dimensional tensor or a matrix. It's just a list, a two-dimensional array of numbers which have this value, right? I'm assuming there's a few tensor network people around here, so most of you may have seen talks with a tensor network diagram before, but if not, a tensor is represented as a circle or an object with legs coming out of it, and every leg is associated with a vector space. And so this tensor here is, for instance, it's a rank four tensor, order four tensor. It takes four indices. Okay? And in this case, this is a very special tensor, this black circle. It's like a Kronecker delta function, but a four-way version of this. So that means I, J, K, and L have to be the same thing. So if this is spin up, let's say, then we end up with spin up here, and spin up here. The same for spin down. Okay? And when I look at this partition function, I can actually write down this sum over product of many things in terms of this tensor network contraction diagram, where all the lines which are joined, there's implicitly a sum here. It's like Einstein notation, right? So when a line joins two tensors, we're summing over that index. And what we see is between, say, two sites, we have one of these factors, right? Which depends on the spin here. So a site lives at the black circle, sorry. A spin lives at the black circle. And another one is here. And so we can get this number just by knowing that spin up and that spin up, and then we have some number there, right? And the reason this is here is that at this site, the matrix to the left, and the matrix above and to the right and below, they should all agree that it's either spin up or spin down, right? And so this thing is mostly full of zeros when they don't agree. So it's just a way of enforcing consistency, more or less. Okay, so don't get too scared about that. It's just a way of writing down a partition function. And yeah, so I'm going to talk about normal Monte Carlo in terms of this tensor network diagram, which is not something people normally draw. So typically in Monte Carlo, the partition function is used to define the probabilities of selecting a sample. I'm going to turn this on its head a little bit later and just calculate the partition function directly. But nonetheless, that's what normally is done. And then from these samples, we calculate expectation values of things like energies and correlation functions and so on. Okay? And to do this efficiently, you have to use a Markov chain algorithm. So you generate one sample, and then from that, you modify it a bit, flip a spin, accept or reject, and use the Metropolis algorithm or something similar. Okay? And you know, using these typical configurations that we get out of this algorithm, we calculate a new sum, which just gives us, say, the expectation value of the energy or something. Okay, so what does the tensor network look like for a particular configuration? Well, if we replace all these black circles with spin up or spin down, let's call that SI, what we get is this. Everything is decomposed into four different things, more or less, all right? So this is spin number 7, right? And this matrix to the left thinks that it's S7, and the matrix above it thinks it's S7, and this one thinks it's S7, and that one thinks it's S7. And then all we have to do to calculate this contribution to the partition function is multiply or just access the element of that matrix, let's say up and down or something, and then multiply all these separate numbers together, right? It just decomposes into a bunch of things which you multiply, and it's very efficient. If we want to do the Metropolis algorithm, we want to ask, do I want to flip that spin or not flip that spin? And the cost of calculating the relative weights, I only really have to, this S8 only contacts four different things, so I only have to look up the value of four new numbers, and it's very fast to figure out whether I should or shouldn't do that. So it's very, very fast to generate a single sample. Okay. So where have people taken this? Well, I mean, the real key part of any numerical technique, really, is how accurate is it? How precise is it? How reliable is it? So the accuracy, or let's say the error, the statistical error associated with E, let's say the energy, is just given by this formula, the variance of E itself and the number of samples. So in what I was talking about before, the variance of E is really the physical variance of E. You know, you think of an experiment of an Ising model system, and you know, at any given time, it really has some configurations of ups and downs. You know, and over time, it visits many different configurations, and there's some variance associated with that. And that's really the Monte Carlo algorithm really sort of simulates this more or less. Okay. Now, people have tried to improve Monte Carlo over time. Obviously, and I would argue that many of the improvements of the really important improvements beyond the first sort of papers was fixing the bottom of this equation, where because of the Markov chain sampling, the Metropolis algorithm or whatever you're doing, the samples are no longer independent. One sample may only differ from the previous sample by flipping one spin, right? So mostly it's the same except for that one spin. So this formula that you learned from like grade 10 statistics or something comes from an assumption that these samples are completely independent. So the effective number of independent samples can be much less than the number of samples your computer actually takes. And so to improve the independence of your samples, you can do things like cluster updates and loop updates and Werger algorithms and so on, which let you access, you know, different parts of, say, the Hilbert space or configuration space faster. Yeah. There's also been some improvements to the top. Important sampling is something which was realized straight away. You may be able to do partial summations. So maybe inside this thing you're trying to calculate, you can perform some of the calculation analytically or numerically and only have to sample over some of the variables, which will improve the variance here. Because it's a sum over less stuff, more or less. It could be very, very implicit. You know, you might be taking advantage of some symmetry like translation invariance or something like that as well. And I would say where this talk fits in is we're really attacking the numerator of this fraction using tensor network techniques. And I want to prove to you, or show to you, I want you to believe that I can make a really very dramatic impact on this number, maybe 10 orders of magnitude or something. Right, so it can be very important, or very useful, I feel. Okay. I think I've been talking too fast. Tensor Network Monte Carlo. Okay. So the idea here is instead of thinking of just taking a single sample, a single configuration at a time, we're going to do what's called multi-sampling. So every one of my tensor network samples is going to account for many, many different physical configurations. Okay? So in fact, in the limit that things are going very well, each sample will account for almost all the partition function, right? So it's actually kind of cool. So when we're doing multi-sampling, what I mean is instead of decomposing this tensor network into product states so that you know, all those bonds, they disconnected, there was only bond dimension one left, there's only, you know, there's no vector spaces or anything left that we have to contract over, right? It's just a product of scalars. One-dimensional matrices, or whatever you want to call them. What we're going to do here is we're going to keep some number d elements of some vector space associated with the bonds, which is greater than one, okay? Unlike before. Some we have to discard because, you know, to do the whole simulation efficiently, we have to throw some things away, otherwise it just doesn't work. And so to do this in a way which is effective and efficient and precise, we're going to steal some ideas from tensor network, you know, renormalizations of tensor networks, and we'll employ those, okay? So that's more or less how these tensor network techniques work, is that they're always trying to do this, work with some larger vector space or something. So when I talk about renormalization, I mean, this can mean many different things to many different people. So I remember reading, you know, about QED and things in undergraduate and stuff, and getting very confused about the idea of renormalization. And you know, you see books by Feynman or whatever, and they talk about removing divergences from field theories and so on. Or you might know about how to do momentum space renormalization to solve the Kondo problem. Or you might have heard of real space renormalization and density matrix renormalization group and all these types of things. But in general, All these things solve problems where you have important physics over many different length scales, right? But here in this talk, what I really mean is approximating one or more tensors with a simpler tensor with a smaller bond dimension using a blocking scheme. So we're going to take a few tensors, put them together, simplify or approximate them, and do it again and again and again And so all we're left with is a small number of tenses, and we can contract everything exactly, and we're finished. Okay, that's the program. And you can do blocking in different ways. You could do like squares go to a smaller square, or you could do what I'm going to talk about is going to be sort of like skinny rectangles, I suppose you would say. So before we go on to the actual blocking scheme for tensor networks, let's convert this tensor network into this one. It's a very simple thing to do. It's not too hard. We just define this tensor that I've drawn in here as this product of square roots of t everywhere, and you can do this transformation. It's nothing special. And then the type of blocking I'm going to do is I'm going to do vertical blocking. Okay, and this is very much related to say TEBD. Or something like this, if you know about tensor networks before. So what we're going to do is we're going to take these two tensors together and put them into a single tensor. And these two, and these two, and these two, right? And eventually we're going to be blocking these vertical tubes, right? And we're going to get down until we have almost no tensors left, and we can just finish the calculation, okay? Now, if we look at this picture, if I really want to think of this thing as a single tensor, I could just do that. And instead of having, say, two indices as this top tensor has, this red circle has three indices coming out of it, the bottom and two on the right. If I continue to do this and combine a third one, then I would have three on the right and then four on the right. And the vector space heading from this tensor towards your right is, you know, maybe it starts as some number d, and then it's d squared, and then d cubed, and d to the fourth, and eventually this is some big number, and we can't deal with this on our computer. We'll run out of memory, and everything will crash and explode and be bad. So what we do is we try and be clever, and we try and project these two bonds onto a smaller vector space using this projector, which is this little triangular thing I've drawn. Okay. So we've taken some large vector space of size, let's call it d squared, and we've projected it to some smaller vector space of size d. And in a minute, I'll talk about how to select such a projector. But once we've done that, we can contract all three of these tensors together into one thing, which is now this new blue tensor. Okay? And you can repeat this scheme over and over and over again. And this is more or less Giffre's time-evolving block decimation scheme, okay? Now, I talked about these projectors. How do we choose the best projector? So we go back to this step. How do I choose what projector to put here? Well, I want to create an accurate simulation, okay? So I'm going to come up with a cost function which describes the error of the approximation of adding one of these projectors in. And we're going to minimize this error. And that's going to be what I call the best projector to put in that position. Okay? So the cost function will be, well, let's just consider the thing I've circled in blue, because we haven't touched these tensors at the bottom yet. We don't know how to deal with them. So we throw them away. And this thing in blue, if you contracted all of it, it's just one big tensor with a lot of legs coming out the bottom. So it's a high dimensional vector or something, like a wave function in quantum mechanics or something like this. And the error is, let's say, it's the error of this boundary state is defined as, say, the two norm distance between before and after the projection squared or something, let's say, for convenience. Okay? So that's my cost function. And it turns out we can actually solve this problem and find the optimal projector, at least on an individual basis. So if I want to put a projector here in the middle, and I want to minimize this cost function, this error, what I can do is I can consider the Schmidt decomposition of this state, so where I have some orthogonal basis of states living on these three bonds called Li, and an orthonormal basis here, Ri, and some positive Schmidt coefficients, or singular values, if you like. All right, and the best approximation is just to keep the d biggest Schmidt coefficients, the d biggest singular values. And this is a type of compression scheme that's used in many different fields. You can use this for image compression. It's okay. It's not quite as good as JPEG, but it's actually not too bad. You can use this for sort of understanding, you know, the dominant correlations in something like people's buying habits or movie watching habits. And so like Netflix had a prize for using this kind of singular value decomposition algorithm to sort of understand the sort of the correlations, the important correlations in people's habits of watching TV shows and movies, right? And Amazon does this kind of thing with your buying habits and so on and so forth. So this is a very common kind of compression scheme, and we use it all the time with matrix product states and PEPs and all these different algorithms for tensor networks. Okay? And yeah, it makes sense. You keep the biggest ones, right? And the error is the sum of the squares of the ones you threw away. Okay? So that's what this is. The error is the sum of all the indices. I mean, if these are in order, a descending order, all the small indices, all the small singular value squared. Okay? And if I did this at the top layer, and then the second layer, and then the third layer, is that a question or a stretch? Okay. I end up with this very funky looking picture, okay, where I've renormalized not just the first layer, but I've then taken this vector space and combined it with the next one and projected it, and then combined that with the fourth vector space and projected that again. And you do this everywhere, and you end up with this system of basically of tubes and this thing at the bottom that I haven't bothered to get rid of yet. But in the end, this is a tensor network which I can contract efficiently without any problems, okay? And if we apply this procedure to some classical problem, I mean, it's done all the time for quantum problems now too. Yes?
It's also rewriting the original tensor network. Suppose you allow for the one dimension,
d squared. Yeah.
It's just rewriting the original.
Yeah, so if these projectors were the identity, then you could call this d squared, and the next one d cubed, and d to the fourth, and so on. And this would be exact. So it's just a rewriting in that case. But at some point, for practical reasons, we have to truncate. We have to apply a projector to a smaller space. But you're right. You're absolutely right. This is a valid way of rewriting the tensor network. And in fact, the Monte Carlo I'm going to talk about takes advantage of this fact that this is just a rewriting and is it samples over a basis where all these things work over, out to be the identity. Okay. But ignoring Monte Carlo, if we do this scheme that I just said, let's call it the variational scheme. Well, what happens as we increase the size or the bond dimension of this vector space that we're projecting onto? Well, the error, this is a log scale, is decreasing very rapidly. So this is actually a critical system. It's decreasing polynomially somehow. And if it's a gap system, it tends to just decrease exponentially in a straight line. Okay, but you can see here, we can go from order 1 to order 10 to the minus 11. Using a relatively small vector space. I mean, we're only talking about matrices which are 35 by 35, right? It's not very challenging for my laptop, okay? But here we're solving some problem where, you know, there are, you know, 10 to the 56, I think, relevant configurations in this problem. So if you wanted to solve it exactly, it would take a large amount of time. Okay, the downside of all this is the projections tend to get rid of correlations, right? So the system will have this variational bias towards phases and states with less correlation. And so if I choose a very small bond dimension, I have some error. And for instance, if I think of an Ising model where the magnetization versus temperature, at low temperature, we have a ferromagnet, and at high temperature, we have just an ordinary disordered paramagnetic phase. Well, the prediction from the tensor network technique is going to be a bit wrong. It's going to favor the paramagnetic phase. And this is a generic problem, right? If we're doing some difficult problem, we don't know sometimes whether our tensor network technique has just gone haywire and chosen the wrong phase and giving us the wrong physics, okay? Whereas the unbiased Monte Carlo, at least when it works, when there's no sign problem, we know that it's probably going to choose the right phase if you've controlled everything sufficiently, okay? And I mean, the good news is that as we increase this bond dimension, the curve tends to converge towards the exact one. And like I just showed on this last slide, even at the critical point where it's most challenging, it's actually converging here very rapidly. Okay, so you can actually get something that looks like the blue curve very, very rapidly, at least for simple one-dimensional quantum systems or two-dimensional classical systems. Okay. All right. Are there any questions so far before I go on to the new things? Okay. Good. So now I want to talk to you about how to combine this with Monte Carlo. So the core idea is to, instead of taking these projectors in a fixed way, we're going to choose them randomly. Okay. So the subspace that we keep is going to be chosen using a random Monte Carlo scheme. Okay. So in terms of these projectors, what would be ideal, remember if you go back to the second slide of my talk, I had this table of pros and cons for Monte Carlo and tensor networks. And one pro for Monte Carlo is that it tends to be unbiased, that in the limit of a large number of samples, we have to get the exact answer. And if we want this to be true with our tensor network projectors, well, we can get this unbiased feature by saying that on average, when we apply these projectors, on average, this is like applying an identity map, which means, as was pointed out, I mean, this big picture with these funny tubes and triangles and everything everywhere, it's just a rewriting of the original tensor network. And we recover the exact result, at least in the limit where we take lots and lots of samples, the infinite number of samples. Okay, so on average, these projectors do nothing, right? So how do we go about choosing these projectors or subspace? Well, we could choose them at random, just completely at random. And it turns out if you average over random projectors, you do get an identity, well, with some prefactor, which we can put in there. But this is a terrible way of doing things. I mean, we want to use important sampling. If I did what I just said, the results would be terrible, the variance would be huge, it would be not at all competitive or useful to even consider, okay? But we can be a little bit more clever, and we can ask ourselves, what choice of projectors that satisfies this thing above can we choose such that we minimize the expectation value of this error function that we talked about before? You know, because from one sample to another sample, we're going to make a different choice. But on average, what's the expectation value over Monte Carlo samples of the error? We call that our cost function. And we want to choose some basis, let's call it a basis of projectors, which minimizes this error. And so if you remember before, there's going to be a few prefactors floating around in the real full thing to make sure this is fine. But more or less, the error that we get is the expectation value of the square of the singular values that we throw away. So for the indices which are not in our sample. Yeah? So if our sample doesn't include one of the bigger Schmidt coefficients, or Schmidt vectors, more important Schmidt vectors, that's bad. That will have a big contribution to the error. If we throw away one which has a very small Schmidt coefficient, that's not so bad. That's okay. That doesn't have a big impact. So that means, more often than not, we want to choose the big ones. And we want to very occasionally choose the small ones. And to take correct for this, so that we have unbiased sampling, we put in some prefactors, which has to do, one, on the probability of selection and so on. So we want to select the big ones more often than the small ones. We never want to select the same index twice, because that's pretty useless, right? We want to choose different parts of the vector space. Yes? Yeah, within a single sample of a single projector, right? So in a few slides I'll get to this, but every sample consists of many choices of many projectors, right? And then a new sample, you re-choose the projectors. Yeah, you could. So there's many, different ways of thinking about that. And like I said earlier, I mentioned this word multi-sampling. So I'm not just choosing one element of this vector space, I'm choosing D of them. Let's say I'm choosing two. Well, the probability of selecting two different things, if they're independent, is just the product of their probabilities. And this is the kind of thing that we use. We use this decomposition, this constraint, this exclusion principle, let's call it, that we exclude the possibility of two indices being the same, and this cost function, that we know that the error of something is proportional to the square of its Schmidt coefficient. And what we end up with, I'll skip all the mathematics and just show you the picture, we end up here with a distribution which looks like a Fermi Dirac distribution. So remember, this isn't really a complete coincidence, because I mentioned this exclusion principle, so it's a lot like fermions. On this axis of this plot is the index I of some vector space that goes up to 100, okay? And in this case, I think I chose that the Schmidt coefficient squared for I was 2 to the minus I, right? Just to generate this picture. And exponential decay of Schmidt coefficients is the common case in gap systems for these tensor networks. So that's okay to think about this, okay? And you end up with this picture where almost all the time we choose the big Schmidt coefficients, almost never we choose the small ones. And in between, I mean this say the 51st or the 52nd Schmidt coefficient, it's really almost as important as like the 49th and the 48th Schmidt coefficient, right? So we sometimes choose these and we sometimes don't choose these and so on, right? And on average, this thing should pretty much minimize this expectation value of this error function that I had before, okay? This distribution, from mathematicians, they call it Fisher's non-central multivariate hypergeometric distribution, where you can only choose one thing at a time, yes? So the chemical potential relates to how many things you're keeping. So this is a canonical thing, so I actually want to keep exactly 50. Oh, right. Right, that's why I put canonical, right? Yes. Well, why? I mean, that means I'm doubly counting the same part of some vector space. I really want to choose a broad spectrum of the vector space and keep it.
But each sample contains 50.
Yeah, so 50 out of 100.
So then it looks like, you know, you take your first sample and with a high probability, it's almost all in the first 50, and then...
No, because in this region, there's like 10 different Schmidt coefficients, so it's very unlikely you choose the top 50, actually. That's kind of rare. It's very likely you choose the top 40, but the next 10 are somewhere in the next 20 or 30.
And when you say you don't want replicas, you mean you don't want replicas of the same index?
Well, I mean, if I choose the same index twice, then I have a vector, like I have basis elements of a vector space which are sort of degenerate, right? So I want to choose a vector space of size 50, but two of my basis elements are equal. So my vector space really only has rank 49.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant independent
samples. No. I mean, yeah. No, but this is a single sample of a single projector. So I want a projector which is a selection of 50 out of 100 basis elements of the vector space. I'm particularly using this basis that we got from the Schmidt decomposition, from the singular value decomposition, right? Because we know this is a good one.
Yes. The type of,
well, if this squared L2 norm is a good measure of error, then it's optimal. You could say that for classical problems, you might want to use an L1 error, L1 regularization or something, okay? Yeah, that's a good question. But if you believe that this L2 error is good, then this is more or less optimal. So it doesn't matter whether you're doing quantum or classical problem, right? Just as long as you, yeah. More questions? Yes?
What plays the role of temperature here? Like
it has to do, if we're really thinking about this as a Fermi Dirac distribution, that it would be like this kind of number here. Yeah, so if they're decaying slowly, then this will be a lot broader, right? let's say. I haven't thought of quantifying it. But that's a good question. Yeah, anyway.
If you look up Fisher's non-central multivariate hypergeometric distribution on Wikipedia,
it will tell you that there's no efficient way to sample this distribution, which turns out to be bollocks. If you know about matrix product states, you can come up with a way of sampling this Fermi-Dirac distribution, right? So I've done that, implemented that. There's code on the internet. So I'm not going to go into the mathematics of how to do all this. If you're interested, look at the paper, talk to me, get the code from the internet, and steal that. Okay? So the procedure as a whole goes like this. We look at the first layer, and within the first layer, we have to choose this projector, and then this projector, and that projector, and that projector, and that projector. And these all involve one of these samples that I just talked about over the last few slides. And then I have to choose all the other projectors at all the other layers until I've got some resulting tensor network which is contractible and easy to calculate. And then I'm done. I call that sample number one. And then I repeat from scratch. I start here and put in independently selected projectors. And I call that sample number two and three. And I average over these. And this is a way to get the partition function Z itself, okay? So this is a perfect sampling scheme, and it gives the partition function once you average over many independent samples, right? So it's a little bit different in goal to typical Monte Carlo, where you're doing Markov chain sampling, you're calculating observables, the partition function's not accessible. But I think, to me, this just demonstrates the power of it, the fact that we're able to do this, and I'll demonstrate that we can in a moment, you know, shows that we're doing something a lot more powerful than standard Monte Carlo. Now we can go back. Yes. Yep. Computing the what function? You mean going back here to get this type of curve?
Yes, so first,
it's like at the boundary, always keeping this matrix product state, more or less. You do the Schmidt decomposition, and you end up with a bunch of Schmidt coefficients. Using those Schmidt coefficients, we can generate some probability distribution like this and sample from it, okay? Relatively efficiently, that's not a leading order cost in the algorithm at all. It's pretty cheap, as Miles will know. And then once we've selected which indices to keep, we go back to the Schmidt decomposition, and we keep those vectors, and we throw away the others, right?
So the compare and the number of steps you have to do for the tensor network contraction, it's busy that you just replace this contraction step.
Yeah, so to go from, I mean, both the standard TBD or what boundary MPS method or whatever you want to call it look like this. Mm-hmm. You can write code that looks like this and replace the line of code which chooses which singular values to keep. You change that single line of code to refer to my function instead of just the maximum, say, function or something. And you're done. It's the same. That code will then generate a single sample. One sample here is the same cost as standard TBD or boundary MPS, or the standard variational method. Yeah.
You are trading the source of error, right? This one.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So the advantage, if you want to call it, is we're exchanging variational error for statistical error. I'd like to prove to you in a moment that they're the same, they're almost equal in magnitude. And with statistical error, I can parallelize, do it 10,000 times, and get something that's 100 times more accurate with a nice little certificate which says my answer is A plus or minus B, right? And it's sort of trustworthy somehow. Does that sort of make sense?
Sorry.
Maybe I don't explain everything very well. Oh,
we're getting far in time. I'm very sorry. Okay, so to give an example of a partition function, we're going to look at the 6-vertex model. The partition function counts all allowable loops configurations where there's no gaps and no crossings,
of lines, okay? And it turns out that in this system, there are 10 to the 56 possible configurations. So we couldn't possibly count them up one at a time. Now, if we use the standard matrix product state technique and contract this thing, we get these red crosses, which converge to the exact thing, right? And if we do the Monte Carlo, I think I have 1,000 samples maybe in this Monte Carlo scheme. What we end up with, ignoring this particular blue point, if you look at all the rest of the blue points, everything is one or two error bars or standard deviations from the exact result, okay? So this little certificate of your error really is working, okay? And sometimes when we're trying to extrapolate and figure out how accurate our simulation is doing, you know, maybe it might be hard to tell that these red crosses haven't converged, for instance. Okay, whereas the Monte Carlo is always hovering around the exact result. The okay, so here I mentioned perfect sampling before. If you do perfect sampling, where you're only taking into account a tiny fraction of the partition function, it doesn't work. No one does perfect sampling with configuration-based Monte Carlo. And you should notice that at bond dimension one, this Monte Carlo is almost exactly the same as standard Monte Carlo. Okay, so the attempt to use perfect sampling with standard Monte Carlo is just, it's known not to work, okay? And we can fix this problem. We can switch to Markov chain sampling. It's not a huge problem. We just have to think about it a little. Here I have the same plot as before, where the error as a function of bond dimension of this model, this is the same plot as before, but before I got rid of all the blue dots. With the blue dots, we can see that it's tracking the same way, okay? So as the standard tensor network approach improves, the variant or the Monte Carlo error per sample, which has to do with the variance, excuse me a moment, is decreasing in exactly the same manner. Lost my clip. That's funny. And we'll just have to hold that off. So they both decrease very rapidly. So if I really want a Monte Carlo accuracy of 10 to the minus 10, starting with a variance of order 1, I would have to do 10 to the 20 samples. Right? We just can't do that with standard Monte Carlo. Here we can get this DMRG-like precision very simply with just a few samples, okay? So we're really upgrading. It's like comparing mean field theory to the full tensor networks. It's like going from standard Monte Carlo to tensor network Monte Carlo, right? We're really getting the same boost in accuracy in terms of how good everything is.
Sorry, I don't understand how to read.
Okay.
So what do you mean by Monte Carlo?
Error per sample. So if I take the square root of the variance, these are independent samples.
So, but you said you obtain these numbers with a small number of samples. This is the part I do not understand.
No, for every blue dot, I think I've done 1,000 samples or something. Yeah? And the actual error of my simulation are these blue dots divided by the square root of the number of samples.
Right,
so so maybe this is a very good point. This is the per sample error. If I plot the actual error of my simulation, it's actually below the red dots. I haven't included them because I wanted to make the plot nice and clean and visible. Okay, so once I've done like 10,000 samples, these move down two orders of magnitude. Okay, and maybe two orders of magnitude or one order of magnitude is important for some applications. It kind of makes sense. But the real message here is this, that the tensor network Monte Carlo inherits the precision of tensor networks, right? The same scaling of precision with bond dimension, okay? And this is more rapid than the standard n to the minus half for Monte Carlo. And so the person doing the simulation has two control knobs. He can increase the number of samples or increase the bond dimension, right? And so he can play with this depending on his hardware and his needs. Right, and so I would sort of recommend using a large bond dimension with 100 samples. The 100 samples are just there to give you a certificate of the error. Right. I'll make another point. If we take the Ising model, I don't know if I need to explain the Ising model to this audience, but it's just the classical model of spins that sort of want to become a ferromagnet at low temperature. If I take this model and look at this is a very, very small system. So all these simulations were sort of done with this laptop. So everything's tiny. So there's a lot of finite size effects here. But if I take an MPS method with a small bond dimension, I get this red curve, which, like I mentioned before, is to the right of the black dots, which is the exact solution. This is a sort of integrable model. Right? Now, if I do my tensor network Monte Carlo with the same bond dimension too, the results are all hovering around the exact curve. So I'd just like to point out that the tensor network Monte Carlo really is unbiased. It always gets into the right phase, you know? If there's not enough correlations in the bond dimension, it will use spatial variations to make up for it, just like standard bond dimension one configuration-based Monte Carlo does. Okay? But we get extra accuracy because each sample has some degree of correlation. So even if you're not perfect with the bond dimension, you're still getting a big boost to accuracy because you get to do some partial summation, which includes a lot of the correlation, but not all of it. Okay. All right. I'm running out of time. I'm just going to skip over these three slides extremely fast. We can upgrade this method to Markov chain sampling. And this will let us do very large systems for the same reason that we don't use perfect sampling with normal Monte Carlo, right? So that, I mean, this is almost like a toy simulation, all the point. But I just wanted to make clear the previous two points, these advantages, okay? We can generalize this to higher dimensions, different geometries. We can do standard quantum Monte Carlo by adding an imaginary time direction. So you have this partition function or path integral with an extra dimension compared to space. We can do projective Monte Carlo. So it's very clear how to apply projective Monte Carlo after a DMRG, for instance. One real reason why research is done on Monte Carlo at all is because of this sign problem. I would hope that because every sample of this method really sums over many different configurations, and it's really this singular value decomposition really attempts to choose an optimal basis where the variance is minimized, I would hope that the singular values and the samples that it chooses really include summing over positive and negative contributions, so you don't end up with these wild variations between plus and minus one, say, and an average of 0.001, which is really hard to sample. You're really just sampling 0.002, 0.0005, you know, somewhere, something a little bit more meaningful. So hopefully it's sign problem resistant. TRG schemes have been shown, standard variational ones, that they don't get negative partition functions. They really just converge the correct way by summing over these really nice vector spaces. So there's some hope for this. It's controversial. It's undecided, it needs to be worked on, I fully admit that. I think we've created the correct hybrid method this time. We've inherited all these things in green and crossed off most of the things in red. There's still some work to be done on quantum problems. In conclusion, I hope that this is a method that if you come from Monte Carlo, even classical Monte Carlo, this might appeal to you. Right, you might want to learn tensor network techniques to make your Monte Carlo 10 orders of magnitude more accurate. I think that's helpful, right? And if you're coming from a tensor network point of view, maybe a zero bias calculation and or some certificate which says what your error is would be attractive, maybe. But yeah. So thank you very much. You can find the details in my paper.
You had the sum over projectors.
Yes.
Equal to like identity.
Yes.
So there are two lines which are like product of two Kronecker delta functions.
Kronecker delta function?
Like,
yes. So I mean, I'm just saying the identity over a large vector space is just a product of identities, right?
So if you look at an individual projector.
Integer projector?
Individual projector.
Yes.
Will it have negative values?
No. No, its eigenvalues
In fact, it's no longer a projector. It has an eigenvalue 0, obviously, where it's projecting out. And the other eigenvalues are the inverse of the appearance rate of that particular Schmidt vector, coefficient, or whatever. This is to make sure that on average, it averages to the identity. On average, its coefficients have to be 1, right? So it has positive eigenvalues, let's say.
Or zero. Are you applying a projector or not?
It's not a projector.
It's not a projector. It's a weighted.
It's a weighted projector. Yeah. So I skipped over that mathematics because I thought it would just be too much. Yes?
So you mentioned one way you could do, you know, say I wanted to study the 2D quantizing model. So one way you could do that is basically take your method and do it in
3 dimensions.
Is that the best way to do it? Or is there kind of an intrinsically quantum...
Well, that
variant of this.
I mean, intrinsically quantum. I mean, intrinsically quantum Monte Carlo is done with this extra spatial, temporal dimension, right? I don't think this is. You have some discretization error. There are what are called continuous time Monte Carlo methods that you could think about. Actually, the sampling, just while you ask this, the sampling can be done starting from an infinite dimensional tensor projecting to a finite space. So you can actually sample over continuous time, or bosons, or different things like this as well.
So I guess I'm wondering, because you know, if I just had a 2D thing and I wanted to do some just variational, like the standard truncation thing, that you'd probably just put in the 2D Hamiltonian. So I'm wondering kind of how the cost scales when you have quantum mechanics relative to.
Sorry, when you go from classical to quantum, you mean? No.
The cost of the Monte Carlo, you know, relative to trying to do some kind of just straight out like. Minimization of the energy using a conventional truncation.
Conventional tensor network technique.
Yeah.
So I think in all cases, the cost of a single sample will work out the same. There is a caveat. In tensor networks, we often take advantage of translation invariants, and we can do infinite systems. In Monte Carlo, these projectors are chosen independently, so it's all finite systems, finite temperatures, just like any other Monte Carlo technique has exactly the same problem. So I should have listed that as an extra con
or in my table. I forgot. I meant to, but I forgot. Yeah. But otherwise, the cost is the same. If you can't assume translation invariance, the cost is the same.
Doing the
so you
could
do this
problem.
With some sort of TBD type PEPs or something.
So doing the quantum problem is not that much harder than doing.
No, I mean, it's just like the standard tensor network quantum problems we do now. Yeah. I mean, how will the sign problem manifest itself in this case? I don't know. I have the feeling that as we increase the bond dimension, the variance will decrease, the sign problem will go away. That's my feeling. But yeah, otherwise, sign problem aside, it works the same as the classical case.
So if you would take a look at a two-dimensional quantum model, right?
Yes.
So you would get a three-dimensional classical
partition function. Three-dimensional path integral, they say.
And how would you choose the projectors there?
Well, the same way. I mean, when you do, say, a TBD type scheme with PEPs, you can do simple updates or full updates. And really, the difference between, say, simple and full updates is your choice of basis to perform these projections in and the Schmidt coefficients and so on. So it works the same. You could resort to the simple update safely. You will get a larger variance than you would otherwise, but on average, you have to get the right result. So you're having a slightly non-optimal, say, choice of projector, but who cares? On average, it averages out to the right thing, right? So long as the sign problem doesn't come up, who cares? It's fine. So you might be able to do it. So you might actually, going back to this question before, you might actually be able to do it cheaper and still get good results, maybe. Results you can trust, which simple update you might not trust.
I don't fully understand why this tensor network Monte Carlo doesn't have the same bias problem as usual.
So, I mean, it's comes back to this formula, really, which I've only drawn as a picture in the slides. This one at the top, let's say, that on average, I'm not doing any renormalization. On average, I'm just calculating the partition function. Right? I mean, why doesn't standard Monte Carlo have
some bias. I mean, every sample is a completely uncorrelated state. Maybe it has singlets or something, but more or less uncorrelated state. And nonetheless, when you average over many configurations, you end up with a highly correlated, maybe critical system or something, right? You know, if you compare this, mean field theory has heaps of bias. But the mean field theory of Monte Carlo is just standard Monte Carlo, and it has no bias.
Yeah, but doesn't the geometric structure of your tensor network enforce a bias on the way you sample?
Ah, yes. So what will happen is if let's say it's targeting the wrong phase or something, doing something strange, the basis that the Schmidt decomposition gives you might not be the best basis for sampling. Remember, all these projection choices are local. Globally, you might want to use a different basis. So yes, in this case, this will affect the variance. You'll have a larger variance. But like I tried to say, in the regions where where the variational technique struggles, the variance is bigger. I don't think you can get around that. That's just life.
More questions? In that case, let's thank you.
Thank you very much.